Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am Michael Matt. This is The Remnant Underground, a very strange and truncated show because I'm actually in Africa right now. But I wanted to just share an interview that we did just before I left, a really important interview of the author of this book, all right? Some of you may remember a few weeks ago, we had a clip of Candace Owens, one of the things, who, by the way, will be at the Catholic Identity Conference. And one of the things that Candace talks a lot about is what the eugenicists did to the black community, how they really used the black community almost like an experimental, like guinea pigs to run all this psychotic culture of death ideology through the black community. They're suffering from that to this day. After we did that clip, the author of this book actually contacted me. Now, before we get any further, this is called Exterminating Poverty, the True Story of the Eugenic Plan to Get Rid of the Poor and a Scottish Doctor Who Fought Against It. Well, the Scottish doctor is a Catholic doctor. Now, I didn't know anything about this man, which is why I'm so pleased that his grandson, after he watched one of our undergrounds, he's from the UK, contacted me and he said, would you be interested in talking about the subject matter of this book, Word Has Simply Got to Get Out. Let me just read you the top of the paragraph on the back of the book. Britain, 1921. A eugenic society was founded to create a race of well-formed, well-endowed, beautiful men and women. The Society for Constructive Birth Control and Racial Progress, that sounds nice, 1921, aimed to increase the offspring of the wise, healthy, and well-to-do, while reducing the progeny of the poor, weak, and unemployed. It lobbied Parliament to pass laws to compulsorily sterilize undesirables. Think about racism. Unbelievable. Sterilize undesirables and set up a clinic to achieve the reduction, the quote, reduction of the birth rate at the wrong part and increase of the birth rate at the right end of the social scale. Now, this is exactly what Candace Owens is talking about. It was happening over in the UK as well. And this story, this book, is all about Dr. Marie Stopes, who is the Margaret Sanger of the UK. I think it's fascinating. It didn't take Mark Sutherland long to attract my attention. Because what are we dealing with right now? One of the things that's really pushed a lot of people into the traditional Catholic, you know, more conservative Catholic, Christian counter-revolution, if you will, is the culture of death. Look what these monsters are doing. Look what they're doing over in Africa. We're in Africa right now. What they're trying to do, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, what they're trying to do to the Africans, to crush their culture, crush their large families. It's the most racist thing in the world. We, the white elites, are going to instruct you and educate you morons on how not to have large families, how not to have the culture that you love and have cherished for 1,000 years, right? It's so perverse. It's so sick. Well, if we're going to fight back effectively, and we need to fight back effectively, these are the same people, the Stopes Foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, these same people that were bankrolling the Great Reset, that bankrolled COVID, right, to take the whole world up. How did we get here? What are we actually looking at? Are we looking at willful evil? Are we looking at ignorance? What is it that we're, what is motive, what is driving this culture of death that we see throughout the whole world, certainly in our country? You got Joe Biden up there bragging how he's going to restore Roe v. Wade if you send me back to the Senate, he says in his delirious, senile state. But you get the point. This Catholic president popped up there in front of the world promising to kill babies. What is going on with this? And how is this not actually just distilled satanic, anti-God, anti-life phenomenon? So this book, I can't recommend it highly enough. Had a chance to sit down and speak to the author. Promised him that we're gonna do it again because I want to learn more about this entire, the history of this whole thing, so that we can know how to fight these guys. But I really want you to, I hope you'll enjoy this next pretty short little interview that we did, a little chat that we did. And again, his name is Mark Sutherland, the grandson of the man who went face-to-face, head-to-head against Dr. Marie Stopes, the Margaret Sanger of UK. I think you're going to enjoy this. I'd really be curious to see what you think. And I hope you'll order this book. We have some information at the end about how you can get a hold of it. So here now, with no further ado, a brief conversation with a man who's right at the heart now. And not only at the heart of the culture of death, but also trying to raise awareness about the Catholic heroes who tried to stop in the past and who are out there right now trying to stop it again. This is our interview. Thank you very much. I'm so excited about our next guest tonight, Mark H. Sutherland, the H standing for Halliday, because your grandfather, Mark, is Dr. Halliday Sutherland, the courageous Scottish doctor who fought against Dr. Marie Stopes in the I think that the case probably should have had a lot more attention, but maybe part of the reason we know that name is because of what your grandfather did to try to stop what was happening with the eugenics movement a long time ago. And the reason I wanted to talk to you, thank you so much for being on our show, the reason I wanted to talk to you is because there seems to be such a fascination. You're coming from Australia, all the way from Australia tonight to be with us, and we just came through the COVID, whatever you want to call it. I have no idea what your position is on what on COVID.
Debacle.
The debacle. Fine. Debacle. Good. That'll make it easier for us to chat. Yeah.
Yes.
And we saw a lot of almost a contempt for life, you know, and we still see almost a contempt for life in pushing vaccines and whatnot that are problematic, to say the least, and there doesn't seem to be any concern. So your grandfather, I think, would have been way ahead of his time in that he saw what was coming, which is basically a hostility to life on the part of the sort of progressive movement. I wonder if we could start off tonight with you just saying a few words about the case, about the book, obviously. The book is all about the case, your grandfather's case, where he was sued by this eugenicist. Tell us, just bring our readers or our viewers quickly up to speed on what your grandfather did and what the case centers around.
Okay, thank you, Michael. And the case took place in 1923 in the High Court in London. Took place when Marie Stopes, who, for those who are not familiar with her name, she's sort of Britain's Margaret Sanger. And she sued my grandfather for libel because in a book called Birth Control, he accused her of experimenting on poor people. The case was won by him. Initially in the High Court, it took place over 5.5 days. He won that, she appealed, she won that, and then it went to the House of Lords in November 1924, and he won conclusively there. Since then, there's been a big historical battle, and it's been completely dominated by the disciples and biographers of Stopes. I got involved in the story because I wanted to know the truth. I wanted to know why my grandfather was so vehemently against so vehemently what had been portrayed to me as a family planning clinic for poor women in a poor part of London where women were having 10, 12, 14 children. I thought, why would you get so mad about that? Surely family planning was sensible. And I should mention at that stage that although baptized a Catholic at birth, when I started the book in 2013, 2014, I was done the sacrament of lapsed, which I've rectified now. So from a very secular point of view, I wondered why he was so vehemently against it. When I looked into it, I realized that Stopes's clinic was not merely family planning. While she was dispensing her pro-race and racial brands of cervical caps to the poor women who attended her clinic free of charge or at cost, what she was also doing was lobbying very strongly for British members of parliament and for the Prime Minister Lloyd George at the time for the compulsory sterilization of poor and working class people. And her definition of the unfit, you know, she called herself a scientist, but her definition of the unfit was so vituperative and just nasty, calling, at one stage she called the children of poor people, she called them the spawn of drunkards. And so basically people, anybody who wasn't well-to-do like Stopes, in the middle, upper middle class, was basically for the chop, and she was campaigning for their sterilization. It's at that stage where I wanted to even up the battle because my grandfather in Stopes' biography is painted as a very, very bad person, toe-cutting zealot. And also, subsequently to that, also to remind Catholics of their history. The fact is today that while we might win the religious arguments, we live in a very secular world, And when you look at the story, it'll actually convince people of the secular arguments as well. Because when contraceptives were proliferated by Stopes in Britain and Sanger in the United States, it was not just about giving women choice. It was about sterilizing the poor, sterilizing anybody whose face didn't fit. And people need to be reminded of that because there was one institution standing against it. And it wasn't the Fabian socialists, and it wasn't the captain of industry, and it wasn't MPs. It was the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's why I wrote the book.
It's interesting. In your book, it seems like she really reacts pretty negatively to the idea of abortion still, right? So they were sort of... abortion had not been approved in many countries, so it's interesting that now, of course, it seems like par for the course. But back then, they were saying, well, we're not talking about abortion; we're talking just about birth control. Is that accurate? Where abortion was still kind of a taboo subject?
I would say no. And as a general statement, one of the reasons I wrote the book, it's a couple of reasons, but one is because when I went to historians on the Stopes side who had written papers about Stopes and drew their attention to my research, I thought, well, you know, I'm going to be their buddy and they're going to like what I've told them and they're going to say thank you for that from Dr. Sutherland's personal papers. Actually, it was quite the opposite. It was a sort of flat ignorance, just completely ignoring. But the other reason is all of the information about Stopes is like in the layers of an onion. And on the surface layer for the public, you'll be told that she was vehemently against abortion. When you go into her papers, you'll see in her own hand that she was an advocate of abortion. Mm-hmm. So there was a letter in the British Library I looked at a couple of years ago by which somebody's writing about this terrible case, poverty, too many children, not very bright mother and father and all of that. And she wrote back and said, look, there's nothing to be done, but you will have to go. And she used a euphemistic term such as evacuating the such and such. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So she was in favor of abortion for people she regarded and called undesirables or defectives. Mm-hmm. But the story that they'll tell you on the surface is that she was against it. The other aspect of abortion at that stage is that I understand, and that's from a good source, from a PhD, from somebody who got a degree in nursing. And she said that at the time there was a tacit understanding between the police and doctors that if the mother's life was in danger, that if whatever the circumstances, that the doctor would flush the products of and that the police wouldn't prosecute. So there was a tacit, informal understanding that way. Mm-hmm. But the reason Stopes wanted to say that she was against abortion so publicly was so that she wouldn't actually be dragged into the opprobrium attached to the people who were doing that.
Sure. Yeah, it's funny how much things change and yet remain the same, because it seems like there's a lot of talk about fake news, but it seems like the media was against your grandfather from the start, and maybe even still, it seems like they're very ambiguous as to who won the case finally after the appeals and everything. And they say that he was sued by Stopes, but they never mention that he won that case, right? I mean, but they don't talk about it. It's kind of interesting, the prejudice against those who were defending the Catholic, the Christian position at that time, even that long ago.
Yes, absolutely. And that's so correct. And actually, I was just flicking through the book in preparation for the interview. And there's a quote from the 11th of July, 1922, from a Father Marnie. And he was debating the whole issue of birth control. And of course, birth control then didn't just mean contraceptives, which is what they represent it now. It was contraception, it was eugenics, it was abortion, it was Malthusianism. And so there was the whole range. And now they just take this off and say, oh, the silly Catholics were against this. Who could be against that?
Right, right.
Bring in the other issues. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Father Marnie said, the exponents of birth control would open the sluice gates to a great many evils, to the use of noxious and harmful drugs, to surgical operations and would have dire results on the family life of England. And as you're saying, fake news, but this priest back in 1922 saw where it was all going.
Yeah. You know, do you get into at all the Lambeth Conference where you know, a contraception was basically approved by most, even most Christian denominations, and the one happy exception would have been the Catholic Church under Pius XI, who comes out with Castor Canubi at that point. I think it was 1927, so just right after all this was happening. And this really interesting and heroic moment for the Catholic Church before she kind of went into her dark period, where the Pope was actually able to influence what men and women, married men and women, were doing behind closed doors. That was the power of the Church still when it came to contraception. And now, you know, reading your book and hearing your story, your grandfather's story, you realize what he was up against. I mean, there really was this whole culture of death that has come out now and that we've all been living through. It was in its nascent stage there, but these people were serious, you know, as your grandfather found out.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And the whole agenda was there. And so one thing that comes to mind, for instance, is in the trial, one of the persons who Stopes wanted as one of her witnesses to testify on her behalf was a chap called Killick Millard, who was the medical officer for Leicester. And Killick Millard, as well as being a birth controller, as in eugenics, Malthusianism, and contraception and the like, he was actually a great proponent of euthanasia. Hmm. You know, eugenics, good breeding; euthanasia, good death. Mm-hmm. And so all of these, this cult of death was actually being set up at that stage. And yeah, it was in its nascent stages. And that's why I think it's such an important history, because people think, oh, that was a long, long time ago. But it wasn't that long ago, and the idea lived on and developed it and developed. And but also the thing is that what they did is they changed their clothes with the times. So back then, you have eugenicists in a pre-mass communication age, and they're talking to each other, and they think, well, no one's going to read our journal. No one's going to read our speeches, so we can say what we like. And they're speaking very plainly, whereas today they sort of guard their words and they promise this paradise world that we'll be in if only we listen to their science.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And this, of course, this is not too far from the rise of National Socialism in Germany, when we saw a little of this kind of come to a frightening level in terms of a state. Were they aware of the connection, do you think, that even with Hitler, Nazism, that was a thing that was already popular? Was it, so you're saying that basically it wasn't taboo at all? They were just discussing these things as though it was going to be the norm, or it was acceptable even that early in the 1920s? That seems hard to believe.
Even before that, I mean, the Eugenics Education Society, as it was then called, was founded in 1908. And, yeah, you know, if you look at the old copies of the Eugenics Journal, the Society's, Eugenics Society's journals, there were lots of people from, you know, sort of Germany, Italy, the United States, all working on this issue, mm-hmm. And Japan also. And with the Germans, they were in the forefront. So the popular history is because they really, really blotted the eugenics, eugenics copybook, as it were. They are the ones who are associated with it. But in fact, it came from Britain. It came from Sir Francis Galton, Charles Darwin's cousin, in the late 1800s. And as I said, the Eugenics Education Society, founded in 1908, it was a very international movement. It's just that when the proverbial hit the fan post-war, the British eugenists and the American eugenists sort of sidled away, sort of, you know, let's move off camera while nobody's watching.
Sure, sure. So do you see a connection then to these early stages of this diabolical movement? Do you think it's fair or unfair to connect it to the sort of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation push to reduce the world's population. Is there a connection, or is that just a coincidence?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, that's absolutely. So, for instance, one of the developments which I outline in the book is that in 1960, the Eugenics Society, it changed its name, but the Eugenics Society is then known, they got a crisis because their numbers have fallen pretty much by half post-war. And so their secretary, Carlos P. Blacker, he recommends to their board or their council or whatever, he says, look, let's adopt a policy which has been successfully taken up in the United States by the eugenicists of crypto-eugenics. And he calls it that. It's literally secret eugenics. Mm-hmm. And subsequently, the board accept that. And at the same time, they said, let's adopt that policy of crypto-eugenics. And also, let's now give a huge donation to International Planned Parenthood Federation and to another family planning movement in Britain. And then subsequently, Stopes's second clinic was bequeathed in her will to the Eugenics Society on her death in 1958. And then subsequently in 1972-ish, it's then reinvigorated as Marie Stopes International that then goes now into 39 countries. Their 2018 target was for 5 million abortions worldwide, and they're apologizing in their report because, sorry, fellas, we only made 4.7 million abortions. So there's a direct link between that continuity. If you go to the books or the financial statements of MSI Reproductive Choices, because coincidentally around the time the book was published, they decided because of Black Lives Matter, they needed to change their name. Big coincidence. Well, I don't know. They won't admit it to me, but I'm hoping. Mm. But anyway, the thing is, big coincidence, they changed their name. But if you look at their list of donors, huge donations come from the Bill and Melinda Gates Association, and also from organizations which the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, with whom they're associated. Mm-hmm. And also, I think it's the Hewlett Foundation. And you just see these names recurring over and over and over again.
What's going on? I mean, sometimes it's so because people from our perspective as Catholics, Christians, we see the good versus evil connection here very clearly. Other people, obviously most people today, don't see that. So this is to us, it seems so obvious. They want to kill babies. They want to reduce family size and all the wonderful things that happen as a result of large families. And we know this, but people are programmed to go against it. And so, let's say that I am someone who just doesn't know anything about the moral questions. What is a Stopes or a Sanger? What are they saying that appeals to me? I mean, they must have like a humanitarian thing that seems a persuasion that makes it appealing to so many millions of people that, well, they must be doing the right thing. They're not just baby killers. They're doing something to serve humanity. What do you think is the strong suit that they have to make this seem legitimate when to us it seems so utterly and absolutely illegitimate?
It's because they obfuscate their intention. And that's partly because I think the people doing the work are well-intentioned. They genuinely help. They think they're helping people in poor countries and stuff like that. I just believe the people at the top, at the Gates Foundation level, the Susan Buffett, Warren Buffett's late wife, that foundation, huge donations. I think at the sort of board level of those organizations, they see what they're doing, and then they'll use the Stopes name and possibly the Sanger name, although that got binned at around the same time that Stopes' name got binned. They use that, I think, one, to inspire the people on the ground doing the work and say, you're helping this great pioneer. But to the people at the board level, nod and a wink, we know why we called it this name. Mm-hmm. And I think there's that duplicity. The other thing I'd say is that I think in Chesterton in Eugenics and Other Evils, his 1912 book, and I won't put it as eloquently as Chesterton, so I won't try, but effectively he said that eugenicists were the masters of obfuscation, because what they do is they come out with all these fine sounding sciencey words. And then a Chesterton would say, okay, so you're going to kill your grandmother. And they go, no. And so when you say kill babies, they say, well, no, we're not. What we're, you know, we want to make sure. Effectively, they say children by choice, not by chance, that it should be planned, that it would liberate women. But the bits that they obscure is the fact my grandfather was saying in 1922. He said, look, if children are the privilege of the rich and not allowed to the poor, Britain will become a slave state.
Wow.
And that women who will only be allowed to go to work and not have children, effectively, you're going to turn Britain into a slave state. He called it the servile state based on his friend's Hilaire Belloc,
mm-hmm.
His book.
Mm-hmm. Very prophetic.
But they always obscure that. But mm-hmm. if you paint this picture, you know, as they do in the abortion debate, they don't say, somebody decided, I can't be bothered to have this baby. I might go and get it terminated.
Mm-hmm.
You always get the worst, you know, somebody was struck by a meteor, the most extreme examples,
mm-hmm.
Which in a secular world lead you to that direction.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is people don't know the history. They genuinely think, oh, well, the government's there to help us. And one of the things about the book is that it's wake up, fellas. There was a movement to get rid of the poor.
Mm-hmm.
And many of these people now saying, oh, Marie, our saint, she really helped us and cared about us. It's like, no, you knuckleheads.
Yeah.
She wanted you dead, or better still, not born at all.
Yeah. Which that seems to be an overlap with Margaret Sanger, her famous or infamous comments about black people. You know, that basically there was an effort to use the same methods to reduce the population of the black folks as well.
Yes.
And thankfully, I think some of that's coming out now and hurt her reputation, not enough, but to some extent. Now, let me ask you this, because it seems odd today with all the science that they have for preventing conception. And maybe this gets too conspiratorial, I don't know. But I mean, there's so many ways of preventing conception. They have all the kids in the schools 24/7 being educated in all of this stuff. They have more knowledge about sex than any generation in the history of humanity. And yet there's no sense of responsibility, and there's no sense of dialing things back on killing babies. You know what I mean? That seems like, so when you look at that evidence, that they still want to kill and slaughter these babies, that they don't even seem to be recognizing that their own sex education is not helping to reduce the number of abortions, do we enter into the realm of that this is some sort of blood sacrament, that there's something actually evil going on that needs the blood of babies for some deity, some evil deity? Is that something you've thought about?
Yes, I believe that is the case. I think that they need to perpetuate and keep that going, because you're quite right. With all of the technology that they have, they don't use it. They won't prevent abortion.
Mm-hmm.
So absolutely. The other thing is, I think it is branched off into distracting people by matters of sex, you know, as a sort of bright, shiny toy to lead people in that direction as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that because when I researched the foundation of Marie Stopes International in 1972-75, I think it was incorporated, it was set up by Tim Black and Phil Harvey, Tim Black being a British guy, British doctor, and Phil Harvey being an American. Now, they both met at the University of North Carolina, and they were both doing a master's in population control, I think, and they met. And they were both sponsored too. They were both fellows of the Ford Foundation, so they were paying for them to go through. They had an assignment and said, well, you know, how can we promote contraception? And so what they did is they set up this condom business where they were selling condoms through the mail. And years later, and, you know, the sort of early 1990s, Tim Black was saying, oh, it's the condom business. When you actually look into it, it wasn't just a condom mail order business. Couple of things. First of all, when they did their assignment, it was illegal to sell contraceptives through the mail, Comstock Act, and Comstock Act, sorry, and they could have gone to jail for it. However, conveniently for these students, they get Planned Parenthood lawyers giving their time and opinions as to what they could do. So that's a bit, sort of well-resourced for a start, which with the Ford Foundation and that, it looks like let's put these people into this direction. Okay. The next thing is they turn their condom business into one of the biggest sex toy and pornography countries in North America. It's the parent company is PHE Inc. It's Phil Harvey Enterprises Inc. And effectively, what they did was they set up Adam and Eve under PHE Inc. About 15% of the profits of that went into Marie Stopes International and other American contraceptives organization. When you look at Marie Stopes International, for the last 10 years, their second and third highest donors. So imagine a list of about 20 donors. The number one is the British Foreign Office or something like that. Number two is Anonymous. Number three is Other. And then, Bill and Melinda Gates and so on like that. Now, normally, Anonymous and Other are for the rats and mice. Sort of, we can't categorize all of these small donations, but they're number two and three. And when I looked into it, I was able to track at least around 6 or 7 million pounds coming in from their pornography business. And so I think it's the whole bag that you get the population down by the proliferation of pornography, you make money out of it, you channel a bit into that, into your favored causes. And so I do think it's the whole package, including abortion as the blood sacrament. Yes.
Did you know your grandfather personally?
No, I was born 6 months after his death. So he died in April 1960, and I was born in October. And so that's why I was named after him. So unfortunately, I never met him.
I kind of wonder
But
as a kid.
through his books, I was able to get to know him.
Isn't that wonderful? Same thing happened to me. I just really got to know my grandfather through a book that I just recently read that he had written. But I was wondering, as a faithful Catholic, what do you think he would think of the sort of wishy-washy position of the Vatican on all these issues that he fought so hard against?
Well, one of the things in his obituary in the British Medical Journal said he was a religious controversialist. And he certainly spoke truth to power. So he, in the 1950s, became involved in the issues about the Magdalene Laundry at Galway. And he wrote about that in his 1956 book, Irish Journey. And the thing is there, he went to see Bishop Brown, the Bishop of Galway, and said, "Look, I want to go see the Galway Laundry." He said, "Why do you want to go? Are you going to write about it?" He said, "Well, if I see something interesting." Anyway, subsequently, what he wrote was censored, and I think that made him very, very angry. And so when the American edition of the book was published in 1960, he effectively said, "Look, the Irish secular clergy have too much power and they are too fond of money." And so just before his death, I think that was him, as far as certain people were concerned, blotting his copybook. And so he was not frightened of speaking truth to power. So I think that he'd probably be like yourself, or associated with yourself, bringing the message to people saying, "Look, what the hell are these fellows doing?" I think he would be.
I think I would have liked your grandfather. I noticed in your book you mentioned that he prayed to St. Thomas More. Is that correct? That was
Yes,
his.
that's correct.
That's interesting.
And he named my uncle, Uncle Richard More. Sutherland was a diocesan priest in the Archdiocese of Westminster. So he was named after St. Thomas More.
Wow.
For speaking truth to power. Yeah.
So tell me before I let you go, how's the book doing? Do you think the message is getting out, or the revisionist history against your grandfather is being corrected, do you think, to a degree?
I have a long way to go. I'm not the best marketer of the book in the world. It's got a long way to go. It got a good review in the Ampleforth Journal about a year ago, which was good. But I'm certainly interested in proliferating the story by, you know, giving presentations on it, and also putting what's happening today with COVID, the lockdowns, transhumanism, abortion, all into the package. It's been going on for a long, long time, at least 100 years. It would also make an excellent story, a feature film, because it's got not just the trial, that would be part of it, but also his stories about his involvement in World War I, his path to Rome, how he actually became a Catholic very late in the piece in 1919, and just the things he did, such as setting up... I'm perhaps going on too long, but effectively he came into this story because he was an atheist or an agnostic. So he calls himself an agnostic by belief and an atheist in practice. And he was a tuberculosis specialist, and he was doing lots of work, such as setting up a Regent's Park bandstand school for tuberculous children, making Britain's first movie, public health information film about tuberculosis. And then he saw the eugenicists shutting it down, saying, look, these people... Quite literally, they were saying tuberculosis is doing a really, really good job of killing off the feeble. And that's more or less a quote from the head of the British Medical Association. Mm-hmm. And so that actually drew him to Catholicism, because it was the only institution standing up against eugenics and Malthusianism. Mm-hmm. And it would make a great screenplay, certainly a documentary, to tell that story, not just as a historical information piece, but get people really thinking and saying, this is not the first time that people have tried to actually reduce the population, and that's putting it kindly. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What they just got better at, it would just make a great movie, I believe.
You know,
but if anybody actually wants me to talk on the issue, certainly interested, and they can contact me through.
I'll contact you next year. Maybe we can get you to come to the Catholic Identity Conference in Pittsburgh, because I think that one of the problems, one of the pieces that's missing from the whole, there is a strong, vital counter-revolution going on right now, but the problem is it's young, and so people don't know the history. And I really think it's very difficult for people to understand, for example, the level of evil that we're dealing with in this culture of death, which is so pervasive. I mean, you look at what's happening in Canada right now, you know, where they're actually going to start telling someone who's suffering from depression that was caused, in my opinion, most often by societal issues, by the breakdown of the family. So in other words, they caused the poor person to suffer seriously from depression. And then they say, well, we're going to help you alleviate your pain by allowing you to kill yourself. I mean, who ever saw it coming to that degree in civilized, quote-unquote, societies? Well, I think we know one guy who did. I think some people like your grandfather were looking at this and saying, this can only end in an extremely destructive society in which everyone's going to suffer. So I really was interested when I saw your book, and thank you for reaching out to us, because it fits into one of our things that we try to do here on this show. We've got to go back and understand how far back this goes, understand the history of what we're actually dealing with, or I think we're going to lose against evil that's been at it for this long.
You're absolutely right. And the thing is that people who go, you got a toothache? Hey, we got a solution for that. Mm-hmm. It's permanent. And it's also cheaper than the state paying for dental care. I mean, it's quite ridiculous how far they've taken that.
Yeah.
But people in the secular materialist argument will say, yeah, but on the other hand, you know, I had an uncle who was very, very sick, and, you know, it was merciful. What they don't understand is this is the thin edge of the wedge of, hey, have a chocolate before you have a few more chocolates, and then you realize there's the poison chocolate, which is intended to kill you. And they don't twig it at this stage. And by the time they do, it's going to be far too late.
Mm-hmm.
They do not realize that they are literally walking into that trap where there will be pressure for them to stop being such a bloody nuisance by being alive and just take this serum. Be it a COVID vaccine or be it a, you know, whatever the Canadians, however they do it.
Right. To say nothing of the total loss of any appreciation for the benefits of suffering. I think that's a conversation you can't even have nowadays. But that was certainly a part of a conversation that people, your grandfather and my grandfather, that generation were still able to have. That suffering, the examples of an older person in a family, for example, dealing with suffering heroically and spiritually and with God's grace and with patience, and that made stronger people in society. That was a great influence on the children and the grandchildren, on what life is all about. And those lessons are something that nowadays is looked on almost like a curse. Suffering is always a curse. Well, I don't know. It seems like that we're really missing something here that our grandparents understood, which is a value of suffering as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being on our show. Again, the name of the book is The Exterminating Poverty, and you are Mark H. Sutherland. I really will do anything I can possibly do to promote your book, because I think this is such an important story to tell. And maybe, like I say, if I can get you to come back to one of our conferences, but certainly back on this show, because I feel like, personally, I'm just scratching the surface with what you're working on here and what your grandfather was working on in terms of eugenicism and eugenics. And I think we could have a lot more and should have a lot more discussions like this to open people's eyes as to what we're really dealing with. So thank you so much for coming on our show.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for your interest and your enthusiasm. I really, really appreciate that.
Great. And how can people get the book? How can they order the book?
That's when I say, oh, it's on Amazon. People, oh, Amazon, they're part of it. On the other hand, what it does enable me to do is to sit at my desk and publish in a lot of countries. But if you go to Amazon, Exterminating Poverty, the true story of the eugenic plan to get rid of the poor and the Scottish doctor who fought against it. Alternatively, there, if you want to learn more about it, if you go to exterminatingpovertybook.com, there are resources on there, such as readings from some of the chapters of the book and an outline of the history. Or if you want to learn more about Dr. Halliday Sutherland, who was a best-selling author in his own time, go to HallidaySutherland.com, where I've curated a website there. And you can contact me through HallidaySutherland.com if you wish as well.
Mark Sutherland, thank you so much for being on our show. God
thank
bless you.
Thank you so much,
Good
Michael.
Luck with the book.
Brilliant.
Thank you so much.
Okay. God bless you, too.
God bless you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.